More fallout of the Zimbabwe suspension, European under-19s qualifying, and a host of emerging international cricket. All that and more around the world and now on 91.3 Sport FM. Welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast, where we dissect the news and events from cricket's new world. Red Gazelle once again bringing us into another Emerging Cricket Podcast. Back again with you wherever you are listening to the podcast and at the home of sport in Perth, 91.3 FM. I'm Daniel Beswick and I'm joined by the usual suspects once more. Tim Cutler. Tim, how are you?
Not too bad, Bez. Happy to be back for another week. How are you going working those three jobs or whatever you're doing at the moment?
Oh, it is pushing the proverbial uphill at the moment, I've got to say, boys. And to compound things further, had to deal with the smash repairers at the moment after someone backed into my car.
Oh, mate.
Yeah, that wasn't great. Actually, they didn't back into my car. They ran up the back of me, you know, for full disclosure. So that's not fun dealing with that as well. But we are here and, you know, it's not about that. It's about emerging cricket, as always. Nick, the man known on Twitter as Copernicus Cricket, Nick Skinner. Nick, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Good to be here again, and I've got the morning off tomorrow, so ready for another long one.
Probably editing this podcast that we record the day before. Let us know where you are enjoying the podcast with the hashtag ECPod. Let's jump straight into our first topic of the week, and it's a big one. The continued fallout Zimbabwe's suspension by the ICC is that Nigeria have now, well, qualified, for a lack of a better term, into the T20 World Cup global qualifier. No repechage tournament, which we were kind of hoping for, though I'm sure it was too difficult to organise or too difficult to afford. So coming from the ICC in a media release, and of course after Zimbabwe's suspension, they've also given Namibia a chance to secure a maiden entry into the ICC Women's T20 World Cup with qualification on that side. But for Nigeria, they finished third at the African Men's Qualifier final and will be the third African side in the qualifier alongside Kenya and Namibia, which is a little bit fortuitous because they were the beneficiaries of a couple of rained out matches and a few other things going their way. Nick, you could probably say that that Uganda would count themselves a little unlucky.
Yeah, the home side in that African regional final, and they finished fourth behind Nigeria. So, I mean, you know, they didn't perform to the best of their abilities, but yeah, as you say, a couple of no results there for Nigeria, really helping them out, especially since the no results came against Namibia and Uganda, who were arguably two of the strongest teams in that tournament. So, yeah, Nigeria, very lucky. I think they've made it there on the back of beating Botswana and Ghana, who, you know, with all due respect, are not the same level as Namibia and Kenya. So good for Nigeria, and I think good for emerging cricket generally to see them both in the under-19s World Cup and now in the global qualifier for the T20 World Cup. But remains to be seen how well they'll actually perform, I think.
Yeah, and look, it's good that the ICC have sort of picked a track here and stuck with it, with the women's and the men's, is trying to keep the regional quota going. I guess we could talk a lot about the relative strength across the regions and similar to, I guess, a FIFA in them picking the certain number of spots to get through to global qualifiers on relative strength or at least perceived strength. But look, it's done. And the reality is the qualifier starts in the middle of October from the men's point of view. So to get five teams together, generally who are amateur players and would have to be taking time off work, or in the case of some of the German players, to be getting out of their county contracts, it wasn't really realistic, was it? So look, if they're going to go away and make a decision without playing a repechage, I'm happy that they went for this way rather than going by rankings. You know, we've talked about rankings and how we think the system's a little bit broken in how it is accounting for teams that have just come into the new T20I ranking system, such as Nepal, who remain at 11th place despite losing to Qatar and Singapore, ranked a long way below them during the Asia qualifiers. So, look, it's not perfect, but in the time frame we've got, I'm happy. And as you said, Nick, great opportunity for a country like Nigeria on the back of a great result to get into the Under-9 World Cup. But 200 million strong population getting behind cricket, that can only be good for the game.
Yeah, and I'm also happy for Namibia as well, for the women's team, who've replaced Zimbabwe, who were they met in the final of the women's qualifier as well, and Namibia were outclassed in that match, but good opportunity for them to try and test their mettle on the world stage as well.
I remember sitting on the balcony at Wanderers. Remember as we were high above the ground after one of the games in World Cricket League Division 2, and they were out there training, and you remarked during the pod there as to how good it was to see them go through their paces and how passionate they were. So a little bit of tidbit there, and I guess it's your little connection to it, isn't it? But it's funny how things can work out in the end.
Yeah, and as I said then, you know, they are committed, and it can only be good for cricket in Namibia as well, with the obviously winning that World Cricket League 2 tournament and getting the ODI status and the 36 ODIs for the men's team. So yeah, getting some more exposure for the women's game as well will be good.
And let's not forget, boys, there was an uneven number of teams, of course, at that African qualifier, and it meant that Zimbabwe had actually played more games heading into the final, and Namibia had a couple of days off, and they looked a little bit underdone in that match. Perhaps this is the luck that Namibia needed. And yeah, I do remember that at World Cricket League 2 quite fondly, them warming up in the evening after the games had finished at Wanderers. Also going back to your rankings discussion there, Tim, Qatar and Singapore are ranked 21st and 22nd. I think I can't remember which one's which, but yeah, 10 places below Nepal, which is quite a gulf in rankings in terms of world cricket. And Nepal is disappointed about not going through per their ranking, but I think a lot of us agree that, as you said, Tim, as well, that the ranking system is a little bit strange and perhaps not quite reflective of the current situation. I don't think Nepal are better than the likes of Ireland, Scotland and the Netherlands, for example. And I think that the qualifiers over there in Singapore sort of proved that. So Nigeria, from a men's perspective, given that there was such little time to get everything together, and of course, as you said, Tim, a lot of amateur players and struggling to get time off work to play in another international tournament would have been hugely difficult and ultimately too difficult for the ICC, which is totally understandable. And it's a great opportunity for Nigeria to show themselves on a bigger scale and to give themselves a chance of going close and playing against some real top players. Some more qualifiers going on were the under-19 European qualifiers for the under-19 World Cup, and it was quite a strong display from Scotland, winning 5 matches from 5, looking fantastic for the future, brushing aside the likes of Ireland, Jersey and the Netherlands, amongst others. Some fantastic individual standouts here for the Scots. Thomas McIntosh with the bat, a century and 250s to his name at just 15 years of age. And two left-arm orthodox spinners, Tim Cutler's bread and butter. We've got Jamie Cairns as well as Charlie Peat. Charlie Peat actually took 7 for 12 against Jersey. Jamie Cairns took a 5 for against Denmark. And he also took multiple wickets in all of his games. Fantastic result for the Scots, but some fantastic cricket on display. Just unfortunately, no streams to watch it on, Nick.
Yeah, it's always disappointing when they can't find the cash for these tournaments. And it, by the looks of it, I think it was a pretty good tournament. And Scotland did go through undefeated, but they had a couple of wobbles, most notably against the Netherlands, where they only sort of scraped over the line by 3 wickets. And the Netherlands looked good too. So there's a lot of talent coming through in the European level as well. You know, you look at Jersey as well, Julius Samarara there, who has played in the senior team a couple of times in 2020, and you know, seam bowler. He actually topped the wicket charts there with 14 wickets from the 5 games. And so, I think there's a lot of strong cricketers coming through in Europe, and especially in Scotland. You look at all the batting numbers, and you know, you've got guys like, obviously you said Tom McIntosh, but there's also Jasper Davidson, who is third on the runs charts as well. So they've got a lot of talent coming through, and I think it's a credit to their development system, which has been growing very well over the last few years, and they've got a great structure in place, and I think it's starting to show.
Yeah, and I think there's a bit of a wobble in their last game as well. They only had to beat Denmark as Ireland were furiously trying to chase down Scotland's net run rate against France in case the Scots fell over. But it was good to see a couple of batters that hadn't necessarily scored as many runs during the tournament inside Shah and Jasper Davidson, who put on 152 for the 5th wicket, which set them up for a chase, well, chase down a big score anyway, and they were able to post 230 for 7. In the end, they bowled out Denmark for 88, so it looks bigger than it was, but there was a bit of wobble early on, but it was good resolve shown by those guys on, it seems to be the bit of wetness around both wickets and outfield in the air, so a couple of the games were shortened. So, you know, as you said, it was just up and up for Scotland. Look, if you didn't know who was the full member between those two teams, between them and Ireland at the moment, you'd probably be saying that Scotland put their noses ahead both on and off the field.
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed with the Danes, to be honest. One of my favourites to follow, and they really struggled, didn't they? Musa Shaheen showed a bit with the bat, a couple of decent scores and a century there, but they were in trouble, and they really were outclassed. It's an interesting point there you make about the four member situation, because the under-19s World Cup qualification happens through rankings at the actual tournament, and which means the 12th ranked full member goes back to regional qualifications. So the question now is that since Ireland missed out, does that mean that the 11th ranked full member goes back to regional qualifications, or are the full members now immune from relegation at the event itself?
Well, who knows what's going to happen if Zimbabwe are back playing again, and if Zimbabwe aren't able to take their position in that top 11, will Ireland take that spot?
Yeah, hoping to get some clarification from the International Cricket Council over the coming weeks and months in regards to that. I'm glad that you guys brought that up, because I'm sitting here scratching my head trying to work it out myself, because there's a lot of moving pieces at the moment with Zimbabwe unfortunately finding themselves in the situation that they're in. Just going through the table for the under-19 European region qualifiers, of course, Scotland 5 from 5 with 10 points. Ireland 8 points, Jersey 6, Netherlands 4, Denmark 2 points, and France, who did fantastically well to qualify for this stage of the tournament, unfortunately losing all 5 games. But I think the positive to take out of it from a French perspective is going through that early qualifier, the first round of qualification, and giving themselves a chance and being able to play some high-level cricket, even at underage level, which is fantastic.
Yeah, France is one of those countries that the ICC and others have sort of had their eye on for a little while, with a bit of observation. They've got a decent playing numbers back there, and especially youth playing numbers. Still a bit of a challenge, obviously, breaking into mainstream French consciousness with a quintessentially British game. But it's one of those countries that I think is going to be on the up as the years go along, and one to watch.
Well, France are playing international cricket on the women's side as well, hosting a women's quadrangular series in Nantes, hosting Norway, Austria and Jersey. Fantastic ground in Nantes, the Parc du Grand Blottereau. And it was the French who took out their home series with some fantastic performances with both ball and bat. Nick, you did read into this with a little bit more depth. Some great young prospects from all the countries, but it's fantastic to see France winning the quadrangular series and beating a more fancied Jersey to the top spot.
Yeah, great effort from them. Good team effort, actually. Everyone sort of contributed, and you look at the stats, you've got the runs are kind of shared around in France, whereas the other teams, it was one or two main contributors. Austria's captain, Andrea May Zepeda, was probably had a bit of a sore back after that tournament, because she topped the run charts and was second on the wickets tally as well, when the rest of them sort of struggled to contribute. Some more young prospects coming through. Jersey especially, the Flo Tanguy and Chloe Greacham with 8 wickets each, and they're both just 13 and 14 years old, as well as Lily Gregg, who's also 14, coming second on the runs tally. But for France, it was the captain, Emmanuel Brolivet, who topped the wickets tally, and she took the only 5-for of the tournament against Austria, where she also scored 38 not out to lead the chase. It was a very low scoring tournament, which does happen in these women's games. No sixes at all scored. Batting in the women's game is a lot more defensive. And that's one of the things, I think I've said it before, but I do like about the women's game is that it's more bowler friendly and more bowler focused. It would have been good to see some of these players and have a look at the talent coming through. But it's worth mentioning that 4 out of the 5 top strike rates came from France, and Isabelle Costaz-Pouilloux was the only player with a strike rate over 100. So obviously they were using the home conditions to their advantage, and it seemed like there was a definite strategy to bowl teams out, because they chose to field each time they won the toss.
Of course, one more point to add, that it was Austria, Norway and France's first T20 women's internationals, and we were able to catch up with French captain Emmanuel Brolivet about their performance.
Emmanuel Brolivet, bienvenue to Emerging Cricket. Firstly, congratulations on the victory for the team and for your performance, taking the most wickets.
Thank you, Nicolas. Thank you for congratulations. I just would like to thank all the players from the team, all the girls, and also the 3 coaches, Andy, Jeremy and Dana, who did great work with us, and we really share this victory together.
So explain to us a little about the background for this tournament.
So every year a country organizes a European tournament, and by the past it was in Jersey, Berlin, Denmark, and also Belgium. Usually there are between 4 and 6 teams from different countries where cricket is emerging. In 2016, we won the tournament in Denmark. It was really great. And then the winner can host the following tournaments, but we didn't do it at this time.
The series was played at an interesting location. Tell us a bit about the Parc du Grand Blottereau.
In France, women cricket is mostly played in two cities, in Nantes, in the west part of France, and in Paris. So I am from the Nantes Cricket Club. I am also captain of the women's team. Then after the victory in Denmark, our club, called NCC, started to work with the mayor of Nantes, and it really works well. We start a common project, very exciting one, to build a cricket ground in Nantes. There are not so many cricket grounds in France, so it was really unique that the mayor accept and support NCC. The ground was inaugurated last year, and then our coach, Andy Jaman, coach from NCC and also the French team coach, thought, why don't we organize a tournament in France, in Nantes? And then it was the beginning of the great adventure led by Maël Carguet, who is the president of the Nantes Cricket Club. Le Parc du Grand Blottereau is a big part in the center of Nantes. It is a so beautiful park with flowers, ponds, and lots of place for children. It's a place family really enjoy. We were so happy and grateful that the mayor created the ground in such beautiful place. The ground is in front of a castle and surrounded by very old trees. So it's very nice. And since it's a public park, when we play, some people pass through the ground and watch and discover cricket, which is very unusual in France. You don't see cricket in lots of places. So we put several panels around the grounds with a few simple rules so people can understand the game. We have one artificial pitch, but for the tournament, Andy Jaman wanted a natural one. So we worked a lot with Patrick, people working in the park, and also with players from NCC, and also one of his friends named Cameron, who was a groundsman in Australia, so who knew very well how to create a natural pitch. They managed to build 3 natural pitches, very good ones, so we were able to play on these 3 pitches for all the 12 games of the tournament.
And so what was the experience of this series like for the players, especially since you don't get to play that many matches?
This tournament is very important for us since we have only one per year. The first aim is to develop cricket in emerging country. And so this year they were Austria, Norway, Jersey and France playing. So we can see progress every year. And it was our first T20 international from official ICC. So it was very important for us. And we are also proud to now have profile on Cricinfo and to go up in the international ranking.
And tell us a bit about some of the players who caught your eye throughout the tournament.
First, I would like to say they were a very good level for all the team. We had to play 2 games against each team, so every time the second game was better than the first one.
In my opinion, some players were emerging and were better than the other, and I think especially of the captain of Austria, Andrea Zepeda. She bowls and bats very well, very good technique, and she really hold her team. It was really a pleasure to play against her and then to speak with her after the game. The captain of Norway, also called Ansar, was a very good bowler. Then we were very impressed by the young girls from Jersey. The youngest one was 10, and they were very good players, very young, like 12 years old. It was really impressive. For France, I should say there are lots of good players, but I think there are 2 players who are all-rounders, and her names are Isabelle Costaz and Jenny King. both very good at bowling, batting and fielding. They were really our strengths in this tournament.
It seemed like this was a very low-scoring tournament. Was that because of the conditions or a high standard of bowling or some other factors?
The highest score was a little bit than 120, which is a good score to us, since the bowling and fielding were very good. And also, you should know the field is not as flat as we can see in England. So sometimes when the ball goes through the slope, it was a little bit slowed down, so there were not so many four. Regarding the French national team, we had to chase, but in second, so we don't reach very high score since we win in less than the 20 series.
And every time France won the toss, you decided to field first. What was the logic behind this decision?
Yes, we decided to field first, since fielding is our best strength. So we bowl well and had a fielding very tight. We have especially two players, Emma Chancé and Tracy Rodriguez, who are excellent fielders. They can stop every ball. They were extra cover and mid-wicket, and they avoid so many four. We are also a team which is good at batting, and we are very good when we chase the score. So it was easier for us to bat in second and to chase the score.
The victory was a team effort from France, with many players contributing wickets and runs. What preparations have you been doing to build a squad with the depth where everybody can contribute?
Yes, as you said, it was really a team effort. Actually, we learned 3 weeks before the tournament our captain can't play, Rebecca Blake. She's such a great player, bowling, batting and fielding very well. We really relied on her so much by the last years. So since she can't be there, we had to do our best to raise our level and stay strong even without her. Every girl was so invested and we share so much together. We are like a big family, knowing very well each other. Because we are from two different teams, but we play all together during the year. And in the beginning of July, we went to a tour in London and played 6 games in a week against local teams. So we had lots of fun, and also we play very good cricket. We really improved during this week since we play very good team. So we had to give our best.
And what's next for the Dames de France?
For the Dames de France, we will keep practice and train to improve again. And we have several games planned with our clubs. But we are really looking forward to the tournament next year. We don't know yet where it will be. And before that, we would like to play against a national team as Austria, Norway. We really enjoy their team spirit and had lots of fun with them after the game. We also would like to play against Germany, who has a very good team, and we played Germany a few years ago, and it will be great to play them again.
And thanks again to Emmanuel Brolivet, captain of the French women's cricket team. We really appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you so much in the name of the Dames de France for inviting me. Hope we will keep in touch.
Let's now cross to Bermuda, where the cup match has ended with Somerset retaining the cup after the match ended in a draw. Nick, you spoke to our Bermuda correspondent, Neil Joyntson, who's talked about the fantastic couple of days over there.
Hi, Neil, and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. I must say I'm pretty jealous of your time at the Cup match this year. For those of our listeners who might not know, what exactly is this famous cricket match in Bermuda?
Cup match is part cricket game and part massive nationwide party. The cricket game is a two-day match between St George's Cricket Club from the east end of Bermuda and Somerset from the west. It's a red ball game played over two innings, hosted on alternate years by the two clubs, this year being held in St George's.
It sounds like there's more to this than just cricket. So what's the cultural and historical significance of the tradition?
It's the most important weekend of the year, having historical significance regarding the granting of freedom to slaves in Bermuda. It's held on the Thursday and Friday closest to the 1st of August, that day in 1834 being the day that slaves were emancipated. In following years, the now free Bermudians refused to work on the 1st of August, instead holding an informal holiday to mark the anniversary of their freedom, and it became customary for a cricket game to be held on the day, the locals having learned the game from the British soldiers posted on the island. In 1902, this was formalised into the Somerset versus St George's Challenge, and a silver cup was bought to compete for, which is still in use today. In 1947, the British government eventually granted the people official days off work for the game, making Bermuda the only country in the world to have a national holiday for a cricket match. The Thursday is officially Emancipation Day, and the Friday is Summer's Day, named after Sir George Somers, who was the captain of an English ship that established Bermuda as a British settlement back in 1609.
And could you paint us a bit of a picture of the celebrations? What was the atmosphere like?
Everyone on the island gets involved in cup match in some way. It's a time for families to get together and celebrate, people often camping out around the island or heading to the beach or out on their boats to enjoy what is traditionally the hottest weekend of the year. The atmosphere at the ground itself is like nothing I've ever encountered anywhere else. There are thousands of fans packed in, decorated in either the red and blue of Somerset or the light and dark blue of St George. There are food stalls selling local delicacies like curried mussel pie and shark hash. The noise in the ground is incredible, with fans bringing in their own sound systems and air horns blasting after every boundary or wicket. It really is deafening at times.
I'm reliably informed that rum swizzle is a popular part of the celebration. So what exactly is it? And to quote a certain fast bowler in a breakfast cereal ad, how many do you do?
Swizzle is a cocktail made from Bermuda's own Gosling's rum and various fruit juices. Fans are allowed to bring in their own swizzle to the ground, and it's a tradition to go around tasting other fans' homemade recipes and boasting that your version of the best, and that can get quite messy by the end of the day, as I'm sure you can imagine. Personally, I was very well behaved on Thursday, but on Friday, my wife made up a rather large batch of her own special recipe, which was very swiftly dispatched in the hot sun, and I was a little sluggish on Saturday, it has to be said.
Good to hear you're back on your feet now. Could you give us a bit of a background on the two teams and the form coming into the match?
The teams are actually representative sides picked from the best players from all clubs all over the island, not just Somerset and St George's clubs themselves. So in this format, they only actually play each other once a year. Form-wise, Somerset have held the Cup since 2012 and were again strong favourites to retain it this year, despite being hit by injuries and retirements to key players ahead of the game, and also missing their star Nottinghamshire man Kamal Leverock. St George's, for their part, recalled 46-year-old Lionel Cant, a skip of the side in the hope of wresting the Cup from their Western rivals, and also recalled key boulder Justin Pitcher.
And what were some of the standout individual performances on the pitch?
On day one, Somerset won the toss and put St George into bat in the first innings. The home team then posted a strong total of 297 for six declared, with half centuries coming from opener Rodney Trott, keeper Tomiko Wilson, Anais Bascom and Mackay Simmons. Somerset replied with a fine batting display of their own, with half centuries from all-rounder Dion Stovall and skipper Jordan De Silva leading the way to a total of 310 all out. And a first innings lead of 18, ending with 55 overs left. Sorry, on day two. As a bit of a funny aside here, it's a fun tradition on cup match that when a player hits a half century or a century, his family and friends will run onto the pitch to celebrate with him amid a cacophony of noise. And when Stovall notched his 50, the Premier of Bermuda himself, David Burt, who is a staunch Somerset fan, ran onto the pitch to congratulate him. I was thinking we should try and replicate this around the world, because who wouldn't want to see Boris Johnson gambling across the Lord's turf to give Joe Root a big hug after a half century? Getting back to the game, the holders retained the trophy in the event of a drawing cup match, so St George really needed to push for a win. Having hit 155 or 44 overs in their second dig, they set Somerset an unlikely 137 to win with just 11 overs remaining in the game.
So the match ended in a draw, but it was a very dramatic conclusion. Tell us about what happened.
Despite not really needing to, Somerset set their stall out to try and go for the win by promoting the big hitting Stovall up the order to open. But sadly, the game ended in very dramatic circumstances when he was hit first ball by a short pitch delivery from Pitcher and collapsed to the ground, dislodging his wickets on the way. It was pretty clear immediately that Stovall was quite badly injured, and with medics and concerned families and family and friends gathering around him on the pitch, the umpires sensibly decided to abandon the game there and then. Cup match 2019 therefore ended in a draw, meaning that Somerset retained the trophy for another year. Dion Stovall was stretchered off and rushed to hospital immediately, but I'm pleased to say that he was later discharged and is on his way to a full recovery now. Nonetheless, it was a distressing end to a fabulous couple of days, but thankfully all ended well, especially for Dion and his Somerset team, who retained the trophy for another year and will look to defend it again in 2020 in Somerset.
Thanks once again to Neil Joynson, Emerging Cricket's Bermuda correspondent.
Yeah, well, some good news after Stovall was felled by that short pitch delivery. quite a brutal way to end a game of cricket, but congratulations to Somerset for retaining the trophy. And my word, it looks like a fantastic atmosphere there in Bermuda for the cup match. And Nick, having two public holidays for a game of cricket, it sounds like our kind of deal.
I think that if you gave me that, that's just basically, that's the dream, isn't it? 2 days of cricket, public holiday. What a place. What a great game. Like, I just, it's such a great tradition too. And it shows the strong cricketing culture in Bermuda that, I mean, ultimately that's culture got them to the World Cup in 2007. And, you know, people sort of use them as a, you know, derisory kind of way of dismissing the idea of having lots of teams. But really, Bermuda's story in getting there is remarkable, and it's a fantastic credit to cricket that they made a World Cup appearance. And I wish people would focus on that side of the story more than the, oh, India scored 400 against them, kicked them out of the World Cup.
And Dwayne Leverock took a catch, yeah.
That was good, though, to be fair.
The fastest Dwayne Leverock ever.
As David Lloyd said, you've still got 9 wickets to take.
Dwayne Leverock, he was an excellent left-arm slow bowler. So I think he, you know, everyone remembers that catch, but he was a serious cricketer in his own right.
It's very much a family affair in Bermuda as well. You see a lot of the same names popping up amongst the players, the pitchers, the outer bridges, guys like that. They're always there, thereabouts. And I think the population of Bermuda is, what, only 65,000 or so. So they make the most of the people that they have there. And I think cup matches are a reflection of that. Let's now move to the Netherlands UAE T20 series in the Netherlands. It was a 4-0 victory for the UAE. Fair play to United Arab Emirates. They were good, consistent with both bat and ball. But team, I think it's fair to say that Ryan Campbell's using this series to look at a host of players for the global qualifier and perhaps even the ODI league with great depth.
Yeah, interesting comparison between the two teams here, where both of the countries had players in Canada for the GT20, and rather than requesting players back from there or from county duties, Cambo's used this as a chance to blood some of his younger players, or when it comes to Steph Myberg, to give a returning player, shall we say, a chance to help him try and complete his squad for the T20 World Cup qualifiers. And while the UAE called back all of their star players bar Shaiman Anmar. So the results say one thing, but I think the opportunity for the Dutch players to get some experience who hadn't was good. We've seen some runs scored by some of the usual suspects, but Ben Cooper's been good. Max O'Dowd's hit a couple of runs as well, which is good, I guess, for the Dutch. But it's an interesting one as to how they're going to come out of this, whether they're happy that they got a chance to blood some of their younger players, especially young Bosselvein, the young leg spinner, who's, I think, 19, or is he 20 yet coming through? He won good spell of 4 overs for 19 in the second T20i. But to go down at home like that would never be good. But here's just hoping it sort of does a lot of hard work for those guys who might get their chance to go on with the Dutch team to the qualifiers in Dubai in October.
Yeah, it's definitely not a full-strength Dutch team. So I don't think they'd be reading too much into it. And you know, the fact that they've given a nearly full-strength UAE team a decent run for their money with what is basically an A-side, Max O'Dowd and Cooper and Zayla probably excluded, that, you know, that's encouraging signs. I think, yeah, Steph Myberg at the top there is a bit of a worry for them. He's not scored many runs, and the runs he did score, he could hardly get the ball to the rope. And that was, you know, from a guy who, I guess, has made his name as a, you know, flying start at the top of the order. He's very much been overtaken in the pecking order, I'd say, by Tobias Fisse.
I was just about to mention Tobias Fisse, who's been playing in Canada, of course. Just quickly looking at some of the bowlers for the Dutch, it looks as if they tried to rotate in almost every game with, I think there was 7 in in the third match, 6 in the first, and then they actually went with 7 again in the second match as well. So they are trying a lot of different things. Both Sikander Zulfikar and Saqib Zulfikar played in the series. Guys like Sebastian Brutt, he made his debut. So plenty of trial. And you mentioned Boy Sevane, of course. Looking at UAE, there was a few key performers. Rohan Mustafi didn't quite do it with the bat, but with the ball, I think he took multiple wickets in most, if not all, the matches, which was fantastic for him. And Ashfaq Ahmed seems to be integrating himself within the UAE setup with great aplomb, and some contributions from the likes of Ramiz Shahzad and Mohammad Usman as well in a couple of games.
Yeah, and we've also seen the emergence of a new player in UAE colours, Dubai-born but brought up in WA. He's played for Western Australia under-23s, is Darius De Silva, up there for best name in cricket as well, I reckon.
Yeah, it seems like Perth is becoming a hotbed of international emerging talent. We saw Tim David, of course, at the Asian T20 World Qualifiers, and now Darius De Silva. Perth getting a great run in recent weeks, and of course with Ryan Campbell as the Dutch coach as well. So a shout out to everyone in Perth and listening to us on 91.3 FM.
Yeah, just going back to the Dutch bowlers and Cambo there, he talked about trying to build a stable of bowlers to rotate, and you know, obviously with people perhaps being injured or in county, or you know, having a lot of depth, and we've seen that coming through. The batting left something to be desired outside the usual suspects, but the bowlers did impress. You know, Bois Vain, even, yeah, it was nice to see Hidde Overdyk get a bit of a run. He's been sort of in and out of the side for a while, and you know, you look at someone like Tony Brat, who is, yeah, a relative newcomer as well. And you know, so seeing all these guys doing well is going to be encouraging for Cambo. And yeah, as I said, I don't think he'll be too unhappy with the results. Obviously, you know, it's always nice to win, but they've got a lot of cricket coming up with the ODI Super League as well. And just talking to Bertus de Jong, actually, he made a pretty good point about the Dutch pitches. Let's just say they're not usually conducive for hitting through the line. They're a bit sluggish sometimes and a bit hard to get set as a batsman. So a lot of the time they'll produce quality bowlers, but batsmen might struggle a bit coming through the Dutch system. And so you'll see a lot of the main contributors, I guess, with the bat are guys who've played a significant amount of cricket overseas.
And of course, the Dutch will be competing in the 2019 ICC T20 World Cup qualifier, which begins on the 11th of October and goes to the 3rd of November. And it is being hosted by the UAE, who they did play in this series. You're talking about Bertus de Jong there. Nick was reading a tweet that he posted not so long ago, which I found quite funny. And he was worried that the Dutch cricket team's 5-year streak of being higher ranked in the world than the Netherlands football team is a very serious risk of being broken. Looks as if after that series loss against the UAE, they might slide down past the 16th FIFA world ranking the Dutch are in football. So that's something that Bertus and others can keep up with. But again, keen to see the Dutch.
I like to keep it proportional. So, you know, the ICC has roughly 100 members and FIFA has roughly 200 members. So, you know, 16, ranked number 16 in the world in FIFA is probably about number 8 in the world for cricket.
Well, back on the topic of cricket, as this is a cricket podcast, Nick, running through the qualifiers for that tournament. Playing in it are Scotland, the Netherlands, Hong Kong, Oman, Ireland, UAE, Papua New Guinea, Kenya, Namibia, Nigeria, who have just found their spot. Jersey, Singapore, and of course the two qualifiers from the Americas in their tournament that starts on the 18th of August. So that's coming up and we'll be covering that here at Emerging Cricket. Staying in Europe now, and we have some T20 matches to look at between Hungary and the Czech Republic, playing a 3-match series, not recognized as T20 internationals, unfortunately. Though it was a great result for the Hungarians, who won the series 2-1 after losing the first match as well. A couple of tight matches in this one, Nick. We saw the Czech Republic win the first match by 2 runs. Hungary then went on to win the second match by 8 wickets, and it was Hungary again, of course, taking the series, winning by 6 runs. Some fantastic performances. Another man who stood out is Hunny Gori, not only for having potentially the best name in emerging cricket, but in among the runs and the wickets, Nick.
Yeah, Picky Jafrans from Namibia with some strong competition in the best name stakes, I think.
We should give a shout out to a good friend of the podcast, Chris Pearce, there in the Czech Republic. Does some great work there developing the game with his dream of having a Czech team come through to represent the country in either World Cup or the Olympics. We'll hopefully get you on soon, Chris. I know we keep saying that we'll talk, but some great stories about his trials and tribulations there and trying to get kids to pick up the game. So just a shout out to a good friend.
Yeah, great. Just great to see that even in a series between two countries that don't perhaps get mentioned, even in emerging circles, are playing such competitive cricket, and to have a series go down to the wire in the third deciding match is fantastic for both teams. So full credit to both of them playing out their matches in Hungary. Let's move to the USA, where we do have a couple of pieces of news. The first one is that the USA have moved their Cricket World Cup League 2 matches from Morrisville, North Carolina to Lauderhill in Florida. It's a strange situation with, of course, the matches being played in the middle of the rainy season in the southeast of the country. There were murmurs that the games were set to be played in Silicon Valley in LA, which would have been a little bit different. Nick, I'm not sure if you're a weatherman of any significance, but it does seem like a rather head-scratching decision.
Yeah, a bit like scheduling a World Cup qualifier in the rainy season in Zimbabwe without any reserve days. Yes, we've heard some whispering of some behind-the-scenes stuff going on, and you know the matches, as you said, they were originally scheduled to be in Morrisville, which I like the Morrisville setup. It's a much smaller town, and but they get really good local engagement because obviously Morrisville, North Carolina, doesn't get a whole lot of international sports. So I think they did a really good job getting good crowds in for the sub-regional leg of the Americas qualifying to the T20 World Cup. Yeah, as you say, putting it in the rainy season doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You could potentially see the whole thing washed out. I think it's not inconceivable that none of the matches will be completed, I think, with this. You know, it rains a lot in Florida this time of year. And the other thing that's a bit strange is that they've scheduled the games all around the weekend, but there are actually no matches on the weekend, and that's to do with the teams arriving at different times and some logistical challenges. But it's pretty disappointing, you know, with the goodwill and the, you know, the good news story of the Americans getting ODI status and, you know, finally making some headway in international cricket, for them to not be scheduling matches on a weekend when they could be trying to promote local engagement and, you know, build up this product that they're trying to sell, which is cricket. Yeah, it's a bit strange, and I don't really understand the decision to move it to Florida, and I don't understand the decision to not have any games on the weekend. But yeah, as I said, from what we've heard, there was a couple of factions at play sort of behind the scenes, and obviously the Florida faction won out in the end.
In terms of scheduling, is it only there'll be no USA ODIs on the weekends, or are there just no games on the weekend?
There's a Sunday game, Sunday the 22nd. So there's only one weekend game, and that's PNG, Namibia. Yeah, so no American games on the weekend.
Yeah, that's a real funny one. I thought with something as big as a Cricket World Cup League 2 and the first time one of these events has been all ODI cricket, and knowing how much, well, it wasn't so much trouble, but I remember when Hong Kong hosted Scotland for the first time, first ODIs ever to be played in Hong Kong, and we knew there was really bad weather coming on the second game. So it was the first game, a rest day, and then the second game, we said, well, we know that there's really bad weather coming on the second game day. Can we bring the match forward? They said, no, you can't, because everybody else has the same schedules and everyone else needs to have the same chance to play two games and not have games moved around. So it's interesting that they've basically bent to the will of USA cricket here in moving the matches away from, as far as we know, a perfectly fine venue to one that's in the middle of hurricane season, and then having no home games on the weekend. It's a little bit of an eyebrow raiser.
Yeah, I can't quite fathom what they're trying to achieve with the scheduling the way it is. Not to mention that there are problems getting visitors or getting spectators to games, because I was just looking at some of the ticket prices that they were putting on the India West Indies T20s in Florida, and the prices were extortionate. The cheapest price you could find for a ticket was something like $60 American, with prices for behind the bowler's arm at something like $130. So they are struggling with trying to get fans into the game in so many respects, whether it's the board, the governing body, or people coming in, bringing international cricket into the country and then trying to make a quick buck. So a few things do need to be ironed out. The USA are lucky in that they've got some international cricket, but for the sake of building the game, you'd want to hope that everything can kind of come together a little bit more.
Yeah, and in the background, we shouldn't forget that they've got some grounds being constructed as we speak, including that one you mentioned that's in Silicon Valley, that's being paid for by the American Cricket Enterprises money as part of the $1 billion T20 league deal. So there are good things happening, but it just seems to be a really strange decision when you're trying to build up goodwill from a fragmented cricket community there, where Morrisville, I remember some of the streams seeing that one, I think it was a tie, wasn't it, went down to a super over with not the best light.
Yes, Rizwan Chima, the hero.
But just shows when things aren't being broadcast about what can be done when there's the will of the players and the crowd. But, you know, it looked like a few hundred, if not a thousand fans around the boundary line really cheering it on, a real great atmosphere. And, you know, you look at the crowds that have turned up for matches like the CPL in Florida and really wonder, is America going to be playing their first ODIs to an empty grandstand at home?
Yeah, I've seen some chat on, I guess, emerging cricket social media about how, you know, there's a few American fans floating around who've said that, you know, they looked at going to watch this series, but the fact that it wasn't on a weekend just made it not really viable. You know, even, you know, Florida locals who couldn't make it because, you know, most people are working during the week. And just, yeah, as you say, it doesn't really make sense to me. Yeah, and Bez, just going back to the point about the India versus West Indies 2020 series that they played there, I think the prices sort of highlights the problem with a lot of these you know, bringing cricket to America kind of ventures. And, you know, we even saw this with the Shane Warne, Sachin Tendulkar cricket all-stars thing a few years back. It's not really about growing local interest. It's about sort of skimming off some money from the local resident cricket lovers who are, you know, starved of live international cricket. And
yeah, desperate for it.
Yeah, like and that's totally fair enough that the boards are trying to make some money out of that and, you know, giving these guys some international cricket to watch. But the problem is that it's not really about developing the game, and I think we've seen that again with this India versus West Indies series.
Just goes to that adage as well about people in the USA. You know, it's a matter of, yes, getting those fans in America who like cricket to watch cricket, but actually getting those people to actually want to watch American cricket is the step. And I'm sure there's a strategic plan seeing there of mapping out the opportunity to convert these fans. But I guess we're wanting to see some movement in that, aren't we, with all of this investment in the game there. And really all we've seen is, and I know this isn't the doing of USA cricket, but seeing that the West Indies, India T20, the very Indian-looking T20 league that's coming, and then to see these games being moved around, it's like, well, when is USA cricket actually going to benefit? When is the game going to benefit within the United States rather than just seeing more sort of pop-up cricket being played?
Yeah, the US is in a pretty interesting situation, I guess, in terms of world cricket, in that it has very high participation rates and it has very high interest in cricket, and that's almost entirely due to the migrant population. You know, the US is a nation built on immigration, and quite a lot of those immigrants have come from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent. So there's a lot of cricket fans in America, but the problem is, and this is affecting Canada as well with the similar, you know, demographics of the Indian Canadians and Caribbean Canadians, of getting the kids into the game and getting the kids' friends into the game, and that's going to be the real challenge. And yeah, as you say, Tim, getting, you know, shifting the I guess the people at the games and the focus of the cricket in America from that immigrant community. And I know it is tempting to just go after the quick money, but I think where they really should be looking at is trying to build for the next generation, and that's where your big bucks are going to come from.
Well, for people interested in watching international cricket in Florida next month, there are matches on the 13th, 17th, 19th, 20th, 22nd and 23rd of September, all in Lauderhill. There's only one match on a weekend, and that's on a Sunday, a match between Papua New Guinea and Namibia. So not even a USA fixture on the only weekend game of the series, which is a little bit head-scratching.
Should be a good game, though.
Yeah, it should. And, of course, all one-day internationals. So plenty on the line for these teams as they look to begin their qualification campaigns for the 2023 Cricket World Cup in India. And sticking to North America and to round out the show, we'll be reviewing the Canadian Global T20 next week in its entirety. And we're going to be joined by two emerging cricket players and two ambassadors of the emerging cricket movement, which is fantastic, in Anshi Rath and Kyle Kurtzer. Looking forward to that. And it's going to get a little bit tight in here, boys. We're going to have five people talking about emerging cricket. The more the merrier, I would say. But yeah, it might get a little bit cozy. So just giving you a bit of a heads up there.
Looking forward to it.
That's Kyle Kurtzer, MBE to you.
Yes, we should. I think that'll be the first topic of conversation is a congratulatory one to him. But in regards to this show, we're going to have to end it there.
And before you go, Bez, and while we're talking about Global T20 in Canada, that I think we need to give ourselves a collective pat on the back. So we talked about it last week, why Anshuman Rath, well, we pondered why Anshuman Rath was batting at number 7 and number 8 behind fast bowlers that don't really bat and wicket-keeping. Well, we know why he's wicket-keeping, but then they finally gave him a chance up the order, opens the innings, bats through for, finishes with 87 not out from 50 and ends up helping getting the Edmonton Royals their first win of a somewhat disappointing tournament. So bravo to us, but and bravo to Anshi. And I think the game earlier that day, Bubba Hyatt, his Hong Kong partner, scored 48 off 23 or something silly like that with about five or six sixes. So good to see the Hong Kong boys lighting it up.
Amazing what happens when you give these excellent emerging cricketers a chance. Anshi Rath could be the best batsman outside the test playing countries, and for him to be given the opportunity and to make the most of it, credit to him.
Yes, and only reiterates my annoyance at the Euro T20 Slam not having dedicated associate overseas spots. We don't get to see Anshuman Rath at the event. We get to see Corbin Bosch.
Well, you never know. Brendan McCullum did retire before the tournament began, so who the hell knows who takes his spot in another interesting move by a professional cricketer, but we'll leave that to a different podcast.
Well, has a certain former Indian star signed for a team yet?
Are we talking about Yuvraj?
Has Yuvraj Singh signed for a team yet? I don't think so. So I think some of those supplementary picks are still yet to come. And
yeah, he might retire. He might retire before.
Well, he's struggled to find form in Canada as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking.
Well, how about the catch that was hit straight at him? He juggled it not once, but twice. But the second one went back over his head and he had to dive to get it. Oh, what an outstanding catch. But it gets the clicks, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I guess it just goes to show, you know, if you give these guys a chance, they'll perform. And this is one of the things that I guess is holding emerging cricket back in some ways, is just people don't get to see them play enough, and so they don't know what they're capable of. And you know, I remember World Cricket League Division 2 in Namibia talking to H.D. Ackerman, who was doing some coaching for the Namibians, and he was talking about how impressed he was with the standard, but basically just he hadn't seen most of these guys play, and that's the thing. And that's why, you know, we've had, I guess, some issues with this Canadian GT20, but yeah, they've done a lot of things right, and having reserve spots for associates is a great move because it puts these guys on the stage, and they can show that they can definitely mix it with the top players.
Yeah, and just to round out that thought, that looking at the Canada squads, I think there's been a few comments. Well, you know, the Euro T20 Slam has 9 local players per squad anyway, but I think the thing that they've done with the GT20 in Canada is they know they can't have a minimum of 6 Canadian in each team because there aren't enough to spread across the 6 franchises. But, you know, we've still got 10 associates, including those Canadian players and the America's pick per squad, where in the Euro Slam squads, there's only the 9 associates and potentially even more full member overseas. So there's still a little bit of room to go there, but no, I agree with you there. I think we're harsh on these competitions for the right reasons, because we think they can be even better. But to see the opportunity these guys are getting, George Muncy hitting Sandeep for 24 off his first over that he faced a couple of days ago is great to see. It's associate on associate in the world's view. Well, not necessarily if you're in Australia, because there's no actual way to watch the tournament, which is somewhat frustrating.
Oh, yeah, that's been annoying. Yeah.
And Tobias Vise, you mentioned him before. For these guys to be getting a chance and to be valued members of these squads is really good to see. So, look, it's great to see. I just think that a few little tweaks could be made for these events to be even better without losing any value from a commercial point of view.
Yeah, and just on the Canadian players, I think they've impressed overall. You know, guys like Dylan Haliger, who's been taking wickets, and Rodrigo Thomas. We saw an over of him smacking JP Duminy around, and he's had a few rapid starts at the top as well. And obviously Nikhil Dutta and Saad Bin Zafar have been impressive as well. And yeah, so it's been great to see the Canadian talent shining as well, especially from a Canadian fan perspective.
Some breaking news out of Canada as we record as well, broken by a friend of the pod, Peter De La Penna at ESPN Crick Info, is that the 2-hour delay of the Montreal Tigers and Toronto Nationals game that was originally reported as a technical delay was actually a pay protest by players of both teams that refused to board their buses to the ground. Players were supposed to be paid 75% of their salaries by last Sunday, which hasn't come through. Quite a sour situation in Canada for everyone involved, guys.
Yeah, gee, it's disappointing, isn't it? So look all the way back to something like the Indian Cricket League before the IPL, where numbers of players took a huge gamble. You know, Ryan Campbell quit his job in Perth to go and play in that, and he still owed tens of thousands of dollars. And even more recently, we've seen the CPL, or at least a number of franchises in the CPL, not pay their players and staff and only pay very late after being threatened with being kicked out of the league. So to see this happen in Canada is very disappointing, especially with a new league and in an emerging nation. It makes you think that with all these tournaments popping up around the world and them having to go through the ICC application and approval process, then perhaps there needs to be a mandated setup of escrow accounts, whether it's centrally held or by the members themselves, for players' fees and even the staff around, whether it's TV broadcast or any of the peripheral staff, to guarantee that the money's going to be there. I've seen a couple of comments on Twitter where people said, well, maybe the PCA should step in there and make sure that players are being paid 50% of their fee up front. But I think this one sort of goes both ways to some degree, where that you want to make sure that A, the players turn up and play, but also that there's money there to pay them. So I think there was a central fund that provided security for payments to everyone involved before the tournament started. I think that would solve it. Well, wouldn't so much solve the issues, because we want to make sure there's enough money to be paying for these events, but it could guarantee and also allow these players to make these big decisions, sometimes putting other jobs on hold or saying no to other contracts to go and play, to make sure that they get paid. Because you've got to think, as we saw from Tim Roy Allen's, I think it was his wife on Facebook, how this affects players' mental health, not even thinking about how they're then going to apply themselves or not on the field, but then how this affects them off when they're home, being able to pay car bills and other day-by-day costs. Then it really does leave them in a very regrettable situation. So hopefully this all gets sorted, but just as importantly, that the same people behind the Euro T20 Slam have all their ducks in a row for that, and they've got the money there to pay the players and everyone as required.
And of course, with Anshu Rath and Kyle Kurtz joining us next week on the pod, they may be able to shed light on the situation. So make sure not to miss that. We're going to have to wrap it up there, boys. But to keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your various social media platforms, and make sure to give us a positive rating wherever you are listening to your podcasts and whichever of the 80 plus countries you're listening to the show from. But Now, from myself, Daniel Beswick, and the boys, Tim Cutler and Nick Skinner, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.